From the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA, it's Sunday House Call with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, call us at 521-TALK. That's 521-8255. Email sundayhousecall@cfra.com. Now here's Dr. Barry Dworkin.
Good afternoon and welcome to edition number 378 for December the 11th, 2011. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin, and you're listening to Sunday House Call, broadcasting live from the studios of News Talk Radio 580 CFRA here in Ottawa, and taking your calls at 521-TALK, 521-8255, star 580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long-distance number. I encourage you to call in earlier rather than later, and that's what some people are doing right now as the lines are starting to fill up. And be more than happy to discuss these issues with you today, any issues you wish to talk about. I also want to let everyone know that I'll be a guest on Rabbi Bulka's show later on this evening at 9 o'clock. Every 3 months or so, we get together and discuss various issues, tries to put me on the spot, that kind of stuff. It's always a lot of fun. So you will have an opportunity as well as that time in case we run out of time with you on the line here towards the end of the show. Also, this will probably be the last show for this particular year with Christmas and New Year's falling on Sundays, and I'll be away next week, so the following week, so there'll be a show right after in January, probably January the 8th, I believe it will be. So again, love to hear from you today, if possible. Otherwise, we may have to wait a little bit of time. Now, I wanted to review very quickly. BBC News has reported recently a study that actually was carried out at the University of Ottawa, at McGill University, and at the University of British Columbia in concert with Oxford University. And what they were looking at was to try and answer a question that has been on the minds of people who have been researching some of the causes of multiple sclerosis. And in this case, it happened to be whether vitamin D plays a role or vitamin D deficiency plays a role in the development of the disease. And what they found is that there was a rare genetic variant which causes reduced levels of vitamin D in people appears to be linked to multiple sclerosis. And the way they did this was actually really neat. This was published in the Annals of Neurology, and they identified a mutated gene in 35 parents of a child with MS, and in each case, the child inherited this particular gene. So what they did is they set out to look for these rare genetic changes that could explain this clustering of MS cases in these families, and they sequenced all the particular gene coding regions in these 43 individuals selected from these families who had four or more members with MS. So these are families with a significant history of MS. And then they compared this to the existing information they had regarding the DNA changes, and they identified a change in a particular gene. They give it a name of CYP27B1, but let's just call it a particular gene. And they said when people inherit two copies of this gene, they get a genetic form of rickets, which is a lack of proper calcium metabolism within the bone, and it's caused by vitamin D deficiency. And just one copy of this mutated gene affected a particular enzyme that led people with it to have lower levels of vitamin D. They then looked for this rare gene variant in over 3,000 families of unaffected parents with a child that had MS. So the parents didn't have MS, but the child did. And this is where they found the 35 parents who carried one copy of this variant along with one normal copy. And in every one of the 35 cases, the child with MS had inherited the mutated version of this gene. Now, Professor George Ebers, who is the lead study author at university, said the odds of this are overwhelming. This is akin to flipping a coin 35 times and getting heads 35 times in a row. The odds of that are 32 billion to one against that happening. So this was a very significant finding. And he also added that this type of particular finding has not been seen in any complex disease at all in the way this has been shown. So it's new evidence that adds to previous observational studies, and observational studies are not the greatest studies in the world. So this is specific evidence, which have suggested that sunshine levels around the globe, those living in northern latitudes, tend to see more people with MS. Scotland being number one, Canada is right up there as well, with greater incidences of MS. And they're saying now that there is now enough evidence to carry out large-scale studies of vitamin D supplements for preventing multiple sclerosis. So this is sort of the next step to see if this actually does pan out. So remember, it's the current opinion right now. Let's not just hang our hats and say very simply that vitamin D is linked to all forms of MS. This was a specific grouping of people with a specific gene variant. And the researchers have suggested that it's a combination of genetic predisposition, environmental factors such as exposure to sunlight, and possibly some sort of other trigger such as viral infections, interact in some way to start the development of MS. So before we see those headlines that say taking vitamin D is going to prevent MS, that's not what this is about. This is doing the research, doing the genetic investigation, showing that in this specific circumstance with this specific gene variant or mutation, it was linked to how vitamin D might play a role in terms of vitamin D deficiency and expressing this form of MS in these particular children. I also wanted to thank Don, one of our listeners, who sent me a link from the Globe and Mail, and this was from December the 4th. It was published last Sunday, and it was called How to Spot Bogus Research by Alex Hutchison. Alex Hutchison writes a whole bunch of, has his own website called sweatscience.com. Very good writer, very evidence-based approach to things, and writes a very good article on what we need to do, and as we've talked about on the show before, what we need to do to spot bogus research, to ask the right questions, to understand how statistics are used, sometimes in many ways that they shouldn't be used, to state that there's a link with something or X causes Y without it really being a valid statistical analysis. So very well written. He showed how several studies were interpreted a certain way, and in fact how one study had been produced that was a bogus study just to fool people, and how the news media harped on it and actually reported it as a real thing without actually doing the investigations. When we come back, we will get to your phone calls, 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372. Is our long distance number as we go to the heavy metal music once again. Thanks, Sebastian. Hopefully something a little softer next time. We'll be back right after the break.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. *580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And going right to the phone lines, and a good afternoon to Tim in Ottawa. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Great. Good. Well, great and not.
All right.
I had some discomfort on my left abdomen underneath the ribs, mm-hmm. and went for an ultrasound, and they picked up some splenic hemangiomas.
Right.
And then I had an MRI, and it confirmed that that's what they were. Regrettably, they found something else, but such is the way things go.
Okay.
But my question about the hemangioma is, I still have discomfort in that area. Should they be presenting any discomfort, and what are the risks of them?
Well, usually hemangiomas are essentially dilated or a conglomeration of blood vessels that come together that form a massive blood vessel. And they're very common. They're not anything that usually presents with clinical effects. That is, you'll see them in the liver, any organ that has a lot of blood perfusing through it. So the liver being one, the spleen being another, because of the nature of that tissue being very soft, you will get blood vessels that dilate, and you'll get these larger areas, but they're not tumors, they're not growths, they're simply just the massive blood vessels in that area. And so in this case, it shouldn't be causing you any pain. Usually pain would be from either an organ getting larger, putting pressure on the capsule that usually holds it in place. That would usually be something to cause the pain. But in and of themselves, they don't really do much damage to the tissue. They're just sort of there. And many of us are walking around with them without even knowing. It's sort of what we call an incidental finding, where you, when you do the ultrasound, you find these, but it really isn't the cause of the condition you're usually investigating.
Okay, so it's just an incidental finding okay, and there's
correct.
No risk, I mean, of anything rupturing, or, and if it does, what's the likelihood?
Yeah, it's extremely rare for those to rupture. It's surrounded by a lot of tissue in and of itself, but it's not a horrible abnormality. It's a variant of what you will see in these organs that have a lot of perfusion, a lot of blood vessels in them, and you will occasionally get the blood vessel that's a bit overly dilated. But it's very rare to see these things rupture or bleed. They're not under tremendous amounts of pressure for them to rupture. And it's more just how they grew as opposed to something that has caused them to happen.
Okay, super. Thank you very much, Doctor.
You're very welcome, Tim.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye now. And 521-TALK, 521-8255, *580 on Bell Mobility, 1-800-580-2372 is our long distance number. And a good afternoon to Sandy in Ottawa.
Hi, Dr.
Hi.
Dworkin.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
I'm calling about my sister. I called you about this before. And I know what she has. She has sebaceous cysts.
Mm-hmm.
But it started in her nose last January, and then it spread to other parts of her body, and she took antibiotics, and it went away. But she can't get rid of the one in her nose. She's had it for a year now,
mm-hmm.
in her nose, way up high. And you can't see them, but she can feel them.
Now, inside the nose?
Yes. Yes, it's almost like in her sinuses. I'm not sure. It's at the top of her nose. You can't see them. She can't reach them. And it drives her crazy because they never go away.
Well, usually, again, a sebaceous cyst is on the skin surface because
yeah.
there are sebaceous glands that are associated with our hair follicles.
Yeah.
So if she has something inside the nose... towards the...
Well, it's under the skin, inside her nose.
Okay, because it might be a different type of cyst altogether. Because again, a sebaceous cyst refers to sebaceous glands.
Yeah.
And those are usually associated with our epidermis, or the skin, our outside skin covering.
Mm-hmm.
It's not usually an anatomical structure that you'll see inside the nose, because that kind of skin is very different. So there may be something else that's going on that's creating this. Have they been visualized? Does she have a scope to look at them?
Yeah,
to see?
If she's been to two ENTs, mm-hmm. they can't see them.
Well, if they can't see them, then they're probably not there. You can't feel a sebaceous cyst. So there must be something.
Oh, I don't know what it is then.
Because she's obviously feeling something, but
yes,
it's...
she said it's very sharp. It feels like there's bones sticking out in there.
Well, if that was the case, though, a scope would see that very easily. So she may be getting a sensation of something that's doing that, but not necessarily the equivalent anatomical change that can be seen for that. So it's hard for me to say exactly what's going on with her.
I know nobody can say. She's been to a dermatologist. She's
right.
been to two ENTs.
But what I can tell you, Sandy, is if they've looked with a scope and looked at the tissue and she's seen a dermatologist and they haven't found anything, then what she's assuming is not correct, and there has to be something else. And that's where you would have to look at a different approach to what her condition is than doing the same thing over and over again. Because a scope, if there was something there, mm-hmm. it's like looking at something on a table. You'd see it.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's nothing there, and especially if you had two ENTs look to see, then the sensation that she's describing, although very real to her, is not reflective of what she thinks is causing it.
Well, the one she had on the rest of her body, they were under her skin, and you couldn't see them. You could, you know, she could feel them, and then they came through.
Well, again, sebaceous cysts are not an infectious process. Sebaceous cysts are blockages of usually the hair follicle that allows oils to build up within the gland. So it's mm-hmm. not something that you're going to see all over a person's body. It just doesn't work like that. A sebaceous cyst is usually one area, one part of the skin. That you'll see a type of cyst. It's not something that, you know, someone develops all at the same time on different parts of their body. So if you don't see them, then it's not there. It's just not, a sebaceous cyst is something that's there. And under the skin, if you can't feel it or see it, it's not there. That's not what a sebaceous cyst is.
Well, what has she got then?
I can't tell you. I haven't seen her.
Yeah, I know, but we even had to go to the emergency. Like, nobody seems to know what's going on.
Well, she's gone through a few of these things that haven't shown what she thinks she has.
Well, so. She says she can feel them, and then they come through, and then it leaves a hole, and it forms a scab, and then she gets another one, and then that's what we thought was going on in her nose.
That's not what a sebaceous cyst does, though. It doesn't form holes. It actually forms a dome, and again, that would be on the outside of the skin. Oh. So I'm not sure what's going on inside the nose. If she's got nosebleeds, you'd see scabs. When you look inside the nose, you'd be able to see damage.
Yeah.
If there's no damage that's there, I don't know what's going on with her.
Well, nobody else seems to know either.
Well, but I don't think she knows either. I mean, the point is that she's giving a history for which there's no corroborative evidence.
Yeah.
So, she has to present herself when this is actually happening. If she says there's a hole in there, then go get this looked at when you have the hole.
Well, we did. We did go to the emergency, yeah. And they gave her antibiotics, but they don't know. They don't see anything in her nose.
Well, then there was no hole.
No, there isn't. It's like something is under her skin there, and it won't come out or whatever.
But that doesn't make that. That's a sensation. That doesn't mean that is what's happening. That's just a sensation she's having.
Yeah. And she says she gets really congested sometimes, mm-hmm. and. She has to use facial saunas all the time.
Well, if she's getting congested, she might have something contributing to the congestion. Some mm-hmm. people have allergies, dust, molds. Mm-hmm. Who knows what can do that? But the point is that when you have two evaluations done by an ENT looking for those changes on the tissue and they don't see it, mm-hmm. you know, saying that you have something under the skin in the nose and it's making holes and you're getting bleeding or scabs, you would see something like that.
No, I don't think they're not doing that. They're just under the skin in her nose, and she says it feels really sharp.
Well, she can have a nerve problem in the nose that's doing that.
Oh, yeah?
But not necessarily. She could have a nerve that's irritated in the nose that's giving her that sensation that's making her think that there's something underneath the skin, but it doesn't mean that there's something under the skin.
And what would she do for that?
That I can't give you an answer. I haven't examined her. I haven't seen her. I can't give you an answer. The two ENTs have been failed to give you the answer to as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I as I said, if there's a nerve issue, if there's something is irritated in the nose, if there's some damage to a nerve,
mm-hmm.
sometimes using a topical anesthetic on the inside of the nose to freeze the skin. There's an ointment that you can use that you can put in the nose to freeze the skin. If that helps her, mm-hmm. that might be a solution. But really, you know, she needs to speak to her physician about getting that kind of ointment and see if that helps. Because
so there wouldn't be anything else, like she couldn't go for an ultrasound or something?
Ultrasound wouldn't tell you very much, especially mm-hmm. in that area.
Mm-hmm.
Again, you're talking about tissue under the skin. And again, you're making the assumption that there's something under the skin. Mm-hmm. From what you're described, I don't think mm-hmm. there's anything under the skin.
Would that be irritated by smoking?
It certainly could be. Is she a smoker?
Yes.
People have to do things to help themselves, Sandy. And
I know, I know. I've been thinking about that, if that was it.
You know, it certainly, I'm not saying that that's what it can be. I'm saying that doing that doesn't help the situation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I'll speak to her about it.
All right.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye now. And we're going to take a small break for the news. We have Brian in Gatineau who would like to talk about a sore back. And Betty in Ottawa has a question about burning eyes. And there are a few more calls coming in as well. And if we get some time, I want to also discuss how an interesting report of how we can use your words against you. With regards to chemical residues on think foods that we eat. It's an interesting comments by the head of the Canada Organic Trade Association. I might review that just after the break, just to give some background. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You are listening to Sunday House Call, and we'll be back right after the news.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA.
I finally made it through med school.
580 CFRA's Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And just before we get to the phone lines, a couple of comments. One I just heard on the news about the city's new helmet law that is going to be enforced for children age 10 and under and weak or non-skaters. How we determine that, I would like to know, to wear helmets while skating in indoor rinks. On the surface, it sounds reasonable. You know, skating on the ice, kids, young kids, especially if they have not been learning to skate or they're just starting off, will fall, obviously, and there's a risk of their head hitting the ice. The question I would have for this policy, just from a scientific point of view, when we want to pass various laws, is I would want to know, and maybe, and I'm certainly hopeful that the data was there, I would like to know what the incidence was of head injuries from falls in skating rinks in Ottawa, in our indoor rinks for children 10 years of age and under, and the degree of injury, the type of injury. And then on the basis of that, if we introduce these laws, to try to determine exactly how much risk we are reducing in terms of having this injury. So are we going to save one head injury, two, 10, 100? So it would just be good to have that evidence to know whether this policy will actually reduce the risk of injury. Because we can take this even further and say that when we fall, especially slipping on the ice, which is essentially what skating is, we tend to fall with outstretched hands. And very commonly what you'll see is an injury called a Colles fracture. Colles fracture is an injury of the wrist. It's a broken wrist. And very common when you fall with full force, slipping backwards or slipping on an ice or on an ice patch, your hands go out to protect your fall. So are we going to, we should actually tabulate how many of those we have and then say, okay, are we then going to introduce some sort of wrist splint type of material or some protective device that now children are going to have to wear to prevent wrist fractures? So again, I'm just sort of trying to ask questions about evidence for policy that might exist, just haven't seen it presented in that way. And if it is indeed something that has evidence to support it, as opposed to another government proposal to control our lives to, in a certain extent, I would like to see it. That's pretty much all I have to say about that issue. We're going to go to line four and say good afternoon to Brian in Gatineau. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Not too badly at all, thank you. I don't know how much you can help me. Any help would be tremendous. My wife has always had not a good back, okay? And about a month ago, she thinks that when she was putting on the bed sheets underneath the mattress, you know, tucking it underneath it, that disturbed her back, and since then it's been horrible. We have gone to our own family doctor. We've gone to, I don't know, anybody you want to mention, acupuncturist, you know, and then physiotherapist and chiropractors and everything else to try and relieve the problem, because it's horrible. She can't get out of bed without, you know, basically crying. And she can't do any washing, preparing meals, anything. It's finished. I just don't know what to do, but we've gone as far as I can think I can possibly go. I wish we could get to see you for recommendations or someone else. I go to our own family doctor, and they said, you know, I've asked her, you know, who's a back specialist that we can go to? And she said, well, a lovely doctor, we like her very much, but she said, well, there's no such thing.
Well, the question I have first is the pain that she is having, is it in the back or down the legs as well?
Back.
So, and no pain in her legs?
No.
Okay. And is the pain, which area of the back, the lower back or mid or upper
I'd
back?
I'd say mid more than anything else.
Okay. And is there anything that relieves the pain? Has she taken anything, any medications at all?
Everything that God has ever prescribed.
Right. And that nothing touches the pain?
No. Prescription, over-the-counter, natural paths, health stores,
right.
We tried them all.
Okay. someone who is having pain, especially to that degree, and is not able to function, from what you're saying, she can't get out of bed or really do anything. She's markedly impaired, from my understanding. Then what we have to, if this hasn't been done yet, is obviously we need to do some imaging to look and see what's happened to the back and especially the spine. Normally, if a disc has ruptured or if there's been a fracture in her spine, which is another possibility, where one of the vertebrae may have collapsed or fractured, that would show up on either an X-ray for fractures or CT scans or MRIs for the back with regards to disc malfunction, a disc rupture, or even spinal cord compression. But usually those type of injuries, especially with a disc rupture or spinal cord that's getting squeezed, it's pain that also runs from that point to where the nerve is going. So usually you would see things happening in the legs or weakness in the leg or difficulty walking, and that's not what's happening. It's pain really in that area. But you still have to evaluate that area of the back. It doesn't sound like muscle wouldn't do that. You know, if you had muscle damage, sure, it would hurt for a bit, but it wouldn't incapacitate to the point of not being able to get out of bed. So that's worrisome to me when you mention that she can't move around. And if she hasn't had any of those things done, then we're sort of working with one hand behind our back, not knowing what the diagnosis is. Because if she does have a fracture of her vertebrae, how old is she, by the way?
79.
Yeah, so it's a very good possibility that she has a fracture. She may have osteoporosis. Certainly she has bones that are not the same strength as they were even 20 years ago. And certain movements can cause a vertebrae to break or even collapse. It just literally, it's like watching one of those buildings just collapse straight downwards. Well, the back can do the same thing where one of the vertebrae just collapses, and that can cause a lot of pain. So I think that's where you need to have an evaluation done, either at the emergency room and say, look, we suspect, and you can even say, I suspect she's fractured a vertebrae in her back. And that would at least cue them into just not putting this into, oh, this is someone with back pain. This is a 79-year-old woman who now has no function, no quality of life, is in pain, medications aren't working. And usually if medications don't work, you know, sure, there are limitations to what medications can do, but if it's not touching her at all, as you've said, she's tried everything, and it's not touching her at all, there's something going on in there that's just overwhelming the medication's capacity to calm it down.
We did go to, as I said, chiropractors.
Right.
And physiotherapists and acupuncturists and everything else. But four treatments after with the acupuncturist, he said, I don't think I can do anything more for her.
Right, and the reason is that there's no diagnosis, right? So before anybody touches her back or pushes on it or manipulates it, you have to get a picture of what that back looks like.
They did take photos, x-rays.
At the chiropractors, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's not good enough. I find many of the x-rays done by chiropractors are not of good quality, and they're not evaluated appropriately. So I really think that she needs to actually have specific back x-rays done at a radiology center. It needs to be read by a radiologist. But at the same time, I still wouldn't rule out the need to do, again, she needs to be evaluated and examined, but I wouldn't rule out the need to do a CT scan or just look at that area of the back that hurts her, especially if you can pinpoint it to a certain area in that back.
How do we in Quebec get an appointment with a doctor like that?
Well, actually, that would be done either through the emergency is one of the ways to do that, where if she's incapacitated and she can't even get into a car.
Yes, she can.
She can. Well, you know, the fact is that she is compromised. She has no quality of life from what you're describing.
Right.
And so that in itself for someone, and she is not able to move around as much. And so for someone who's 79, who may have severe damage in her back, who can't walk around or move around, she's also at increased risk for blood clots, which is very commonly seen in people older folks who don't move around because of disability. So this is an urgent thing. This is not something where you wait several weeks to see someone. This is, you have to go to the eMERGE and really push them and say, you know, she has no quality of life. She's lying around. She has pain in the back. No medications have worked. All the ancillary therapies that we've tried have not been helpful. You have to tell them, I want you to look at that back. I want you to do a scan of this back. Tell me if she has a fracture or if she has a disc problem. And that's the question they have to answer for you. And they can't answer that question, especially with regards to fractures, without doing the appropriate imaging or scanning of that back. And that's really the only, because she needs something done quickly. You can't wait 2 or 3 weeks. It's just, she's going to decompensate even more. Her muscle mass is going to atrophy. She's not going to be able to move around as well. And this kind of thing, really, for someone at that age and someone who is suffering like that, not fair for them to be waiting weeks and weeks to have that evaluated.
Well, and I appreciate every word you said. I really do.
Okay.
I just don't know how I can get the emergency to respond to that, you know. The doctor says I can't refer to emergency, you know.
Well, no, but you can go to the Emerge.
Yes.
And the doctor could send her to the emergency. We do that all the time with patients where we send a small note and the physician says, you know, I'm concerned she may have a burst fracture of her vertebrae. Pain was sudden in onset. She's not able to walk or not able to move. She's in bed. And that's done all the time. You can ask your family doctor as well tomorrow to say, can you please give me a note that I can take to the emergency room questioning whether she has a fracture of a vertebrae?
Mm-hmm.
And that's another way to approach it, because waiting for a consult and waiting to see someone is going to take you weeks. And that's not in the cards for her. That's not what should be done. This is an urgent thing because she's having an acute, very sudden problem that happened, you know, literally while she was doing something, fixing the bed sheets. And she likely did something to her back, the structure of her back. And it doesn't sound like muscle. From what you're describing, it does not sound like muscle tissue that's been affected. It sounds like there's been more structural or bone involved, and that really needs to be looked at.
Thank you for all of that. Is there any way of contacting you if we don't get anywhere?
You can certainly send me an email to at beadworkin@cfra.com.
Okay.
That's probably the best way to do that.
Thanks very much for your help.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Bye. And we're going to take a small break, and when we come back, we have Betty in Ottawa. We'd like to talk about burning eyes, and Bill in Prescott about carpal tunnel syndrome. Tim on his cell phone has a question about knee injuries, and Laura Lee also would like to discuss low magnesium levels. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. You're listening to Sunday House Call. Back in just a few minutes.
Dr. Barry Dworkin, Sunday House Call, News Talk Radio 580, CFRA. CFRA Sunday House Call, your weekly checkup with Dr. Barry Dworkin. Call us at 521-TALK, 521-8255, or email the doctor, sundayhousecall@cfra.com.
And good afternoon to Betty in Ottawa.
Yes.
Hi.
Hello.
How are you?
Oh, not too bad, thank you. I'm wondering, Doctor, I had cataracts removed in March and April, mm-hmm. and my eyes seem to be fine at the time, but for the last couple of months, I've been having this burning and they're bloodshot. Like, even when I get up in the morning, mm-hmm. it used to be that, you know, maybe in the afternoon they would get burning and
right.
they would be bloodshot. But now, even like in the morning when I get up, they're bloodshot and like sore.
Well, this is probably unrelated to the cataract surgery that you had.
No, I realized that because I went back to my ophthalmologist.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you have red eyes or bloodshot mm-hmm. eyes, that indicates an inflammatory process.
Mm-hmm.
Potentially, if it's been there for several months, it's mm-hmm. unlikely to be an infection usually because mm-hmm. infections, especially if it's bacterial, you'd have a lot of stuff coming out of the eyes.
No.
If it was viral, it would be red for a while and disappear. But the point mm-hmm. that you're having, it's both eyes that are like this,
mm-hmm.
that they're red and burning,
mm-hmm.
tells me that your eyes are reacting to something, either something that is touching them, some allergy-related phenomenon, or some other inflammatory condition that hasn't been diagnosed yet. So there, what I would suggest then is that this would, especially if it's been 2 months,
mm-hmm.
this needs to be evaluated. You need to
yeah.
see either your family doctor at first or your ophthalmologist
mm-hmm.
To look at the eyes, to try and make a diagnosis of what is causing it. There certainly are drops that are used to reduce inflammation and discomfort in the eye, but ultimately you want to have a diagnosis first before you start treating, because you need to know what you're treating. So what I would say is that if it's been 2 months and they've been bloodshot like this and it's happening every day, you need to have these looked at. I wouldn't wait too long, because it could be reflective of other illnesses. It could be reflective just of eye conditions, but it certainly sounds like some inflammation from a specific cause is leading to these eyes getting bloodshot and causing the burning. The burning is because they're inflamed.
It couldn't be like because of kidney or...
Unlikely from that, but but ideally they have to be looked at, because usually diagnoses of eye conditions are usually done by looking at the tissue, because that usually helps you with the diagnosis.
And kind of a headache, you know, like my head seems kind of full.
Yeah, well, especially if your eyes are hurting, it can give you headaches as well. It's right near the forehead, everything tightens up, and you can certainly get a headache. So what I'd say, Betty, is that I think it's important for you to be able to at least see someone within the next day or two.
Have my doctor refer me.
And have those eyes looked at, absolutely.
I went to an ophthalmologist, you know, a month ago or so, and she looked at them, and she said, no, you know, they seem to be fine.
Right, but were they bloodshot at the time?
Not as bad.
Yeah, and so they would have to see it when it's when it's red, because
that's right,
like anything else, if it disappears, then everything's going to look okay.
Okay, thank you, doctor.
You're very welcome, Betty.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. And over to line 7, and Bill in Prescott, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, doctor. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm talking about carpal tunnel.
Yes.
I had a conduction velocity test, and it's moderate bordering severe on one hand and moderate bordering on the other. And when I was running, I have to get a carpal tunnel operation, some people say sometimes it doesn't always work. And I was just wondering, in the case when something doesn't work, what is a person to do? I don't know what happens to your hand, whether it's going paralyzed or whether there's... I've had physiotherapy and a chiropractor and this puncturing acupuncture, and it didn't seem to help.
Right.
So at this point, I'm putting all pins, depending on the operation. But if the operation isn't successful, what was the person do after that?
Well, the first thing, to step back just one step before that, carpal tunnel syndrome is when there is compression of, there's a nerve called the median nerve. It's median,
right.
It's in the middle of your middle of the wrist. It passes into your hand. And if it's compressed by... tissue that runs over your wrist,
and
it's a band of tissue that runs from, you know, if you look at the palm of your hand, it runs.
Yes, I have pictures of it.
Yeah, it runs across, and that tissue is called the flexor retinaculum.
That's right.
So, what the surgery is they cut that particular tissue and they release the nerve, which is why it's called the carpal tunnel release.
That's right.
Now, a lot of times, if it doesn't work, it's because the nerve has been so damaged over time that the surgery was done late.
I see.
And the nerve has already been compromised. In your situation, it's moderate to severe, but at the same time, doing nothing will mean that it's continually going to be compressed and you will lose function of your hand over time, because the muscle of your thumb, the muscles around your thumb, need that nerve to function properly. And what happens when that nerve stops providing adequate stimulation to those muscles is you lose the ability to oppose your thumb. You can't bring your thumb over to your pinky anymore.
I see.
And so you lose the gripping ability of the hand. So when they do the surgery, they release the nerve. It can take months. The other aspect is it can take months for the nerve to recover, because it's already been squashed. That's essentially what it is. And it can take time for it to repair itself. But really, if they're recommending the carpal tunnel release at this point, it must mean that there's quite marked reduction in conduction of the information or the electricity through that nerve.
It always saves time to get an operation done. You know,
That's the other thing as well. So in case, let's go forward and say, well, you do the surgery and it doesn't work. Well, the reason why it wouldn't work is if either there are other structures that are pushing on the nerve, which is less likely given the anatomy, or the nerve has been damaged, again, past the point of no return. And so that's usually why those surgeries don't work, is because of pre-existing damage.
Oh, hopefully
when they do these surgeries, it will relieve the nerve and that your nerve hasn't passed that point, and that it will gradually, as I said, it can take months, 3 to 6 months, before you get your full function back and the tingling and the numbness and the shaking your hand at night when you're sleeping, all those things, hopefully that will disappear for you. So again, if they recommend the surgery, I would do it, because not doing the surgery for out of concern that there may be a treatment failure with it still guarantees that your nerve is going to get worse. So there's really no, in terms of risk benefit, you can only benefit from the surgery, because doing nothing means the risk is too great.
So the point of past return means that you can't do anything at all, or?
It means that the nerve has been damaged to the point that you can't do anything to make that nerve
work. So it won't come back
better
on its own then.
That's correct. But most of the time, I should tell you, most of the time when they do the surgeries, they do work very well. Mm-hmm. The other thing to consider is, you know, for any time there's post-operative situations where you do a surgery, you also have to ask people what they did after the surgery. Did they start lifting and moving things too much, too quickly?
Oh, I realize that.
And that kind of stuff
that
as well. So,
yes.
So I would take it with a grain of salt when people are saying, yeah, the surgery doesn't work. You got to really, you would have to get this done, because, as I said, doing nothing means that it is going to get permanently damaged.
That's right. Well, thank you very much, Doctor.
You're very welcome, Bill. All the best. And my apologies to Laura Lee. Unfortunately, we have about 25 seconds left. I'm on with Rabbi Bulka later on this evening at 9 o'clock. My thanks to Sebastian for producing another good show, heavy metal music aside. And we'll be back in January with another edition of Sunday House Call. I'm Dr. Barry Dworkin. Have a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.